going to just give you the information beginning of chapter 6. And this will probably seem weird. I mean, somewhat strange, you know, somewhat foreign. And then I'll explain it after we get some of the information on the page. He says that Hashem organized the world so that it should run similarly to the way a human government runs. In particular, in judging a person, evaluating a person, there are courts and groups that evaluate what happens and make decisions. And each of these courts and groups has its rules and procedures. The higher courts, the lower courts. Now, just as when we spoke about the chain of influences from God into the world, and we said that God is present at every link, at every step on the ladder. Nothing functions by itself. So here also, he said, makes the same point again, that God himself is manifest at every level, higher courts, lower courts, this body, that body. And he is the one who directs them and brings about what they do. So then the question is, if he's there and he's doing it, what does he need that for? What's their function? And then, thinking of them as courts, so some cases the judges in the court are there doing their thing, and God, of course, is there because he's at every level. In some cases, God himself is one of the judges on the court, together with others who are also judges. And there are angels who function as prosecutors and angels who function as defense and angels who function as witnesses to bring information before the court. There are times when the courts are in session and times when the courts are not in session. Major judgments, minor judgments, we call Rosh Hashanah Yom HaDin, Day of Judgment. Implies that some kind of judgment is going on in Rosh Hashanah that isn't going on January 6th. And whenever any action is judged, there could be thousands and thousands of angels who come to testify, because every aspect of the action and every aspect of the agent is at least potentially relevant to making the judgment that needs to be made. It's not like in our courts where the judgment is only external. You ran a red light, so you get this and this penalty. You did it twice, you lose your license for 50 days, and you know, that's the rule. No, but in God's court, everything is taken into account. What kind of pressure were you under, and how was your marriage, and how was your physical health, and your psychological health, and how was your monetary situation, and so forth and so on. All these things are taken into account. You're judging the person and what he did. Now, the big question that Lutzata faces here is, God is infinite. God is everywhere. God knows everything. Why then have a procedure like this? The instant someone performs an action, God can judge it and respond to it with perfect knowledge and perfect appropriateness. He doesn't have to wait 6 months until Rosh Hashanah. He doesn't need external agencies to bring in evidence. He doesn't need other agencies to be judges, lower courts, higher courts, associates. He doesn't need any of this. And especially since he hasn't really abandoned the world to this agency. There are other religions that have a conception that the Creator created the world and went on holiday. It's a big pain in the neck to deal with people day by day, you know? So they just leave it to the lower functionaries, let them take care of it, and they'll, you know, pay a visit from time to time. No, he makes the point explicitly. He's at every level, and he's involved in every court that does anything. No, so if that's so, why did he set it up that way? What's it for? Now, I answered this question for you a few weeks ago in a slightly different connection. Anybody remember what I said? What the point is here? This is based on Zohar. Other things I'm sure, I don't know. The point is that how God runs the world should be something we can understand. The investment here is in human understanding. That's the reason he does it that way. He sets it up according to rules, institutions, procedures that make sense. Number one, we can understand them. And number two, we can sympathize with them. We can identify with them. You could imagine having it done by rules, but the rules look to us as totally arbitrary, meaningless, amoral. I take the average temperature of the day, the average humidity of the day, multiply it by 13, and if your name's gematria is less than 1/6 of that, you get punched. And if it's more than 1/6 of that, you don't get punched. That's a rule. I can understand the rule, but I can't relate to it. That's not, you know, it's not a rule that has any validity, justification to me. No. So it's set up in a way that we can understand it. Because what we are supposed to accomplish here depends crucially on our understanding. That's the axiom. The big axiom here is, it's not enough to go through life blind. It's not enough just to take orders. It's not enough just to be dutiful, faithful, reliable. It also has to be done out of understanding. The mind is an essential element in our relationship to God, our connection to God, our attachment to God. And therefore, I'm using a key word, a code word, he reduces, you know the word in Hebrew, you can use it, he reduces his infinity in action to a finite chunk, that we will be able to appreciate. Yeah.
You mentioned that he does it in a way so that we can relate to it. Such as,
well, I said understand.
Understand.
Yeah.
So isn't he the one that put that understanding that we can, you know, in the first place? The way we see, just like morals. I mean, this is probably a big discussion, so I won't use morals. But like the government that we have, so we understand it, right? Because it's what we live with, but. Wasn't that with before? Hadn't you get to understand the government? When the government was established, you know, that was something that he put down. He made. Okay. So how could? So it doesn't make sense that he made the world so that we can understand what he put us to understand in the first place.
I'll try to do it for a little bit further perspective, but if this doesn't work, maybe you and I should talk about it along with that. I'm not following the difficulty here. God, who is infinite, is going to create a creature who's finite. Now, that means that what God is infinitely beyond that creature's ability to understand. Now, how are they going to interact? They could interact in such a way that the creature can't understand. William James gives the example of you and your pet dog. You know? How do your world and your pet dog's world intersect? Well, it's like this. There's a circle here, and they intersect at one point. That's about it. What can the dog appreciate of your worldview, your purposes, your goals, your hopes, your dreams? If he gets fed regularly, you know, and gets deloused regularly, he's happy. There's nothing else that Brian matters to him. You do that for him, he'll be loyal to you. That's a type of interaction. The dog doesn't have a clue what's going on. He just gets his needs served. It's not like, for example, a teacher and a student. Let's say the student is 15, and the teacher is working on a project and says to the student, listen, I need help on the project. Here are ways which you can help. Look up these things in the library and bring the information, talk about the song. So the 15-year-old is using 15-year-old abilities to participate in the project. He understands the project, more or less. He has some idea of what's going on. And he can make a contribution where he is, in his mind, he understands the project that he's contributing to. That's a different kind of relationship. God wants a relationship with us on a par with an adult with a 15-year-old and not a human being with a dog. To do that, he's got to reduce himself in action. If he will make use of his infinite being in all of his actions, then we'll be left with the blank. Things will happen, but we have no idea why they're happening, where they're coming from, what they mean, what to expect to happen tomorrow, because we'll be like the dog to the human being. So what does he do? He reduces his infinity in action, and he operates according to certain rules. Rules that are the rules that we can appreciate, that we can understand in our finitude. And he does that only so that we'll be able to understand. That's why he does it that way. Otherwise, it's... So that's the picture here. When he says they're court, but God is present in the court, and he's the one who's influencing them to do what they please, so then the court is just another name for him operating in a limited way. That's really what it is. He's really there. It's not if somebody else is there. But it's him operating in the guise of this limited concept, even though he himself is utterly beyond it. Yeah.
I understand what you're saying, that God created this like heavenly justice system so we can understand it. Is it that he created it like that because we've got it like that down here, or is it we have it like we have down here because he created it like that?
Oh, that's a deep question. That's a deep question. And I will do a little work here. Since you raised it, there's an important principle here. Lutzato, I think, only hints at this. Others speak it out in more detail. There is a mitzvah to...
Is this question again?
Sorry?
Is this question again?
The question is it that we have courts and therefore he operates according to the court system so that we'll understand? Or does he operate according to a court system and that's why we have courts? Which comes first and which comes second? Is he an imitation of us or are we an imitation of him?
So I was trying
to... Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I understand it better now. Good? There's a mitzvah of honoring your parents. Here's the way many people understand it. We are a sexually reproducing species. That means every human being, well, most of the time, almost all the time, barring for me, right? And therefore, if a human being is here, he's here because a man and a woman cooperated in his sperm. That means he has a special biological relationship to those people. In the normal case, he also has a special psychological and social relationship to them. They raised him. That's a fact about our world. Now, what shall we do with that fact? How shall we react to that fact? How shall we deal with that fact? What way shall we incorporate that fact into our spirituality? Ah, the Torah goes along with the mitzvah. Honor your parents. Here are the rules. Honor and have all your parents. And here are the rules. The way you should treat these people who are biologically, for sure, and socially, psychologically, almost always special to you. Here's what you do with that fact. Now, the truth is that that's exactly upside down. That's exactly wrong. And what's wrong with it is the way the question was put. The question was put like this. We have a biological, social, and psychological fact. That's a fact on the ground. Now, how do we respond to that fact? The fact is given. The fact is given. The only question is how we're going to deal with the fact. Now here's the truth. The truth is that we should question the fact. Don't take the fact for granted. Why is it that we are a sexually reproducing species. And don't give me evolution is revolution. I don't care whether it's true or false. The question will be, why is evolution set up that way? Why is the world set up that way? The world isn't Hefker. It's not running by accident. The question is aimed at the physical fact. Why is the physical that way? And the answer is, the reason we are a sexually reproducing species is because there's a mitzvah of honoring your parents. So there has to be parents. The biological scheme is explained by the fact that there's a mitzvah. And only with this biological scheme can you fulfill the mitzvah. The mitzvah comes first, and the biological scheme exists only as a reflection of the mitzvah. This is exactly right. And this idea of which comes first has many applications. For example, we say that when we talk about God's eyes, that's an anthropomorphism. God doesn't really have eyes. Ridiculous. No, God is a physical being. So what do we mean when we talk about God's eyes? I guess we mean something like he has instant information about whatever goes on. See, when we look at the world with our eyes, we get instant information. With these flesh and blood organs and the light waves surrounding us, we get instant information. That's usually very accurate information. So when we speak about God's eyes, it's kind of a metaphor. It's a loose, poetical way of saying that he has instant information. That's exactly wrong. That's exactly wrong. It's exactly upside down. The Hebrew word ayin refers literally to what he has. And then it's only borrowed poetically to refer to our flesh and blood eyes. So if you want to know what the Hebrew word ayin means, it means a certain capacity of God to have knowledge, however he has knowledge. And then instant, accurate, effortless knowledge. And then we look at the human being and say, well, where does the human being have something like that? Knowledge that he gets instantly, effortlessly, and accurately. Vision. Just opens his eyes and sees. So we borrow the word ayin in Hebrew from God's capacities, and we use it by analogy, by extension, by metaphor for human capacities. That's why Hebrew is called Lashon HaKodesh, the holy language, the language of holiness, because Hebrew is designed to describe literally the holiness, and then it's borrowed from other things that apply elsewhere. This is what it means when it says that the Torah is the blueprint of the world. It means, just like when an architect creates a blueprint for a building, the blueprint comes first, and the building comes afterward. And the contractor is standing there with the blueprint in his hands, and every time he makes a move, he looks back at the blueprint and says, oh, I'll put it over there. Yeah, blue, steel, glass, because that's what it says in the blueprint. So if you're looking for explanations, you look at the physical and you ask why, and the explanation is in the blueprint, not the other way around. So we have things exactly upside down in the way we normally look at them. For each circumstance in the world, we should ask, what spiritual principle is it created to express? This idea, it's a common idea in many sforim. Rabbi Yisrei, Rosh Yeshiva of Philadelphia Yeshiva, spoke at a Buddha convention 22 years ago, expressed this idea, and he applied it to a very interesting example. Why is it that human beings take longer to mature than any other species, both in absolute time and in a percentage of their lifetimes? The human maturation period is very long. Human beings can't function independently till 7 or 8 years old, for sure. Many animals, it's a couple of months to fully function. Don't need any help after that. And the help they need is very little. That's all internally programmed.
Sometimes it takes 30 years.
For an animal?
No, for a human.
Yeah, that's right. You're going to be a doctor. You're 30, that's right. Why is it that way? Now, you say, well, we are neotenous apes. No, that's what I'll tell you. We're apes that have a slowdown in the development period, and therefore, that's biology. It's either true or it isn't true, but it's not relevant. Because even if you'll have the biological mechanism by which it happens, the question why God set up a world in that mechanism is still there. That doesn't help answer the why question. Now listen to his answer. He says, the truth about the world, about the Creator, about the revelations to Noah, to his children, to Adam, to later to Sinai, these truths have to be communicated from generation to generation. And they are the body of information. It's fairly extensive, complex information. So God created the human being in such a way that there's a period of time in which the human being is totally helpless, totally dependent upon his parents. And almost everything his parents do is instantly verifiable. The child says to the parent, out of this tap comes cold water, out of that tap comes hot water. And the parent is right. The parent says to the child, this is how you tie your shoes. And the parent is right. The parent says to the child, go into this class. That's your kindergarten class. And when the teacher reads the roster of names, his name is on there. The parent is right. You know, press this button, the lights will go on. Press that button, the lights will go off. This is how to turn on get the BBC. If you want, it's a comedy station. And almost everything the parent tells the child is right. So for a few years, the parent has extremely high credibility in the eyes of the child. And during those years, the parent can communicate to the child the tradition on God's relationship to the world. That's why, he says explicitly, it applies to non-Jews as well as Jews, because they have their part of the tradition that they have to communicate. So this is really the right way to look at it. The right way to look at it is to raise the question about the physical fact and to answer it in terms of what part of the Torah it reflects. Yeah,
your question. I'm saying that the reason we get to reproduction is for the sake of that it was already a myth, right? So isn't that kind of like limiting God in a way that he has to create some sort of system where we produce our own kind?
Where did the myth come from?
Sorry.
And where did the Torah come from?
Same time as God.
I don't understand. We said that.
You understand the answer, right? I mean, you don't understand. Look, he commanded the mitzvah, and then he created the physical reality to fit the mitzvah. He's not limited in any way. I mean, he chose the mitzvah, and then he chose the reality to fit the mitzvah. It's all his play. It's all his show, right? Sort of like if a guy writes the play and then acts it out, limiting himself to now the script, and he's got to read the script. He wrote the script, right? So he's not limited by the script. Yeah.
I understand. We said that our sight is a metaphor from God's eyes, or whatever. But how are we supposed to understand what God's eyes are?
Again, the word "ayin" refers to His power.
How do you know that is?
Oh, okay, okay, good. They actually talk about this.
What was the question?
Oy vey. Well, I'll answer it. That'll be easier to before I go. Just to hear the answer. Oh, there was a noted philosopher in the secular world. When I was doing philosophy, he was considered to be the big gun. Today, almost everything he taught is ignored by the world of philosophy. It's unbelievable. His name is Quine, the Lord Norman Quine. And he wrote a paper in which he said that what's more fundamental than what depends upon what kind of question you're asking. It could be that in one sense, A is more fundamental than B, and in another sense, B is more fundamental than A. And in particular, he distinguished what's more fundamental metaphysically in the world, the building blocks of the world, versus what's more fundamental epistemologically in terms of evidence and coming to know. Now, what is a table made out of? Ultimately, particles, quarks, something else, something like that, right? That's what it's ultimately made out of. Molecules, atoms, particles, right? So if you ask, what is the most fundamental building block of the world? It's those tiny little parts. Now I ask, how do you know anything about tables? You don't start with electrons. We haven't got electrons. You know something about tables by looking and dealing with the concrete table. And then doing experiments, and thinking about the experiment, and then thinking up theories. And in the order of knowledge, electrons are last. They're the last thing you come to. In the order of building blocks, electrons are first. So there's a big difference between what one could call the metaphysical order, the order of building blocks out of which everything is made, and the what you could call the epistemological, the intellectual order, the order in which you come to know things. You come to know about the table first by interacting with the whole blooming thing without knowing anything about its structure. And then you go through a long intellectual process by which you finally arrive at the idea that there are electrons there. So it's the exact opposite. In building the table, the electrons are first. Intellectually, in terms of learning evidence, they're last. Now, here it's exactly right. Metaphysically, in terms of the reality, the word ayin refers to a fundamental power that God has, and only refers to our eyes as analogy to that power that God has. So in terms of the reality, the metaphysical reality here, God's power comes first, and us, we, and our power is only an analogy to that. But, as Benny points out quite rightly, if I'm going to figure out what power it is, I'm going to start with what I have. Because that's what I have. That's where I am. I know what the eye does for me. And I can thereby form some conception of that power it is of God that the word I in Hebrew refers to. So the intellectual order is going to start with me and go to God. But the order of reality starts with God and moves to me. They're moving in opposite directions. It's a very important observation. Yeah?
So for the courtroom, for the justice system, the heavenly justice system, we're saying that ours is that's like that.
Yes, ultimately it's got to be like that. In other words, we find it natural, reasonable, moral, just, efficient, appropriate to do it this way, because God set up that kind of concept, that kind of structure, as part of the way He runs the world, and we reflect it that way. And so reflected in the structure of our minds, also. Quite right. Okay, well that's very good. I wasn't going to do that, but I think that's very important to have on the third. Okay.
Good. So, I think I asked this 2 weeks ago, and you said that in terms of, like, what we were talking about was right, but there was something else also, about the angel being just like limited God, the peace. Anything else is an angel besides God acting in a limited way?
What can I say? It's a difficult subject. Whether an angel has any being, or it's just a metaphor, it looks like it does have some kind of being. Now, what kind of being it has, I don't know. Beyond that, I can't say. We spoke once about the fact that angels might have a limited form of free will. If they have a limited form of free will, they can be punished for what they do. You cannot take that as just a metaphor for God's action. So, I'm not quite sure what to say about that.
Do you know if there are genders in the angels?
Don't know. I have to check the proving. Check the proving. I don't know.
Didn't we say yesterday that the male and female, in terms of human, has nothing to do with the spiritual side of him? It's only his body.
No. Oh my gosh. If that's the way it came across, then I gotta say it again. So I said something else. I can hear where you. I didn't use those words, and I didn't mean to imply that concept. What I said was that, according to Maor Shomish, one of the great Hasidic thinkers, the soul in and of itself is neither male nor female. The distinction between male and female is how the soul expresses itself in this world. So, of course, it's the body that marks the differentiation. But the soul has to be tuned, let's say. Tuned to express itself in a male form or a female form. Now, that tuning is artificial. That tuning is sort of like, you know, you have a light and you have these filters that they put on the light to give you different colors. When you see red light coming out, it doesn't mean the thing's red light. It's white light with all the spectrum of hues in it. But there's a red filter on it. So that's the picture that I meant to say. The soul has this undifferentiated spirituality. It's sort of filtered and tuned to play the role with the particular body that it's going to be connected. But then, in the world to come, it reverts to its own, and the body has to be absorbed into that somehow. Yeah.
So the soul is just basically either gender, and then it's, so the soul could be the same soul could be in one case a male.
According to that could happen. Yes.
Do they choose the soul or God chooses?
What's that?
Does the soul choose whether or not to take?
Soul doesn't choose anything. That's one of the reasons that Mishnah says that the soul is very unhappy about coming into the world altogether. As it gets shoved in. Okay, now he has a chapter here on the influence of the stars. I'm not going to do this in detail. There isn't too much detail. I'll just tell you this. This is a very important thing. My mother actually talks about this. It's a little disturbing. Is there any truth to astrology?
Shall I make you all angry?
It's sort of like alternative medicine. Now, isn't it true that people who get sick can be cured by eating certain things? Isn't that true? Yeah, it's true. They get cured sometimes by eating penicillin in certain forms, or injecting things like insulin. I'm a diabetic. That's a piece of my life. Isn't it true? Okay, so we took plankton and strained it through purple cloth, and we whispered incantations over it, and you're eating it. So isn't that medicine? I mean, you eat these things to get well. You eat those things to get well. So, you know, it's all eating. It's all getting well. It's all, you know, eating because you're sick. So, well, like, you know, it's not exactly sort of like that. You know, that's just eating anything. You don't pick it because it smells good. There's a way to test.
By the way, a friend of mine, who's a doctor, told me that the New England Journal of Medicine, which is maybe the most famous and reputable journal in the world, 2 years ago, the editor wrote a letter, and he said, there's no such thing as alternative medicine. It's just medicine. If you test it and it works, it's good. If you don't test it, then it's no good. Or at least you have no right to say that it's good.
I don't care whether you're sticking needles into people or into dolls. I don't care whether you're running incantations or twirling around on a bed on a swivel. What do I care what you're doing? If you can reproduce it and it survives testing, then it's worth it. And if it doesn't survive testing, it's not worth it. I don't care whether it came from the South American jungles or whether it came from NIH. Who cares what it came from and who cares what it's made out of? Either it's reproducible or it isn't. If it's reproducible, it's medicine. If it's not, it's not. Now, if I tell you that the stars do have some kind of influence, that is not to say that your local astrologer in the newspaper or the guy on the street corner for a nickel, you know, will give you your horoscope has any truth to what he's doing. He's in the right ballpark, but he's playing the wrong game. The astrology that you have that's popularly available is all bunk. It's just bunk. A number of studies have been done. You know, these horoscopes, and you pick them up and you look up your horoscope and they look at it. Gosh, you know, that really? Well, you know what they did? They tried people out on reversed horoscopes. They just scrambled the dates and gave the people, you know what? The same number of people said that it really fit them. With scrambled dates. It doesn't make any difference. I don't know if she's still around, but there's a famous astrologer named Jean Dixon. She had columns in hundreds of newspapers. Imagine, she wasn't poor. I remember from the Nixon era, Uncle Tricky Dick Nixon, that she predicted when he was under fire that he will survive this crisis and come out a stronger president. And I said at the time, that's great. She made a concrete prediction, and in a few months we'll know for sure, one way or the other. Well, as some of you know, he resigned and, you know, was lost to the presidency and to history and all the rest. That doesn't stop people from reading her column. It didn't reduce her popularity. She goes right on, you know, what she did before. So to say that the stars really have an influence is not to give credence to any of the claptrap that you have around that's called astrology. That's just nonsense, yeah.
Is there a method that you can, you know, utilize the stars in a way to predict?
He says that we understand so little of it in detail that it's not really available to us. I don't know who for us is. Maybe the prophets in their times did have some ability to understand it. Maybe buried deep in the Kabbalah someplace, there's something on it. But certainly, it's not available to the vast majority of us. I have never seen anything on it.
It's like not like tarot cards, nothing.
No, that's more of the nonsense. That's more of the nonsense. That's, you know, yeah.
I think it was about when you were talking about faith about 2 weeks ago. You mentioned a story where there's one guy, a Roman guy sitting with a Gemara person, and the Roman guy looks in the stars and sees that one of the workers is going to die. How can you explain? I mean, obviously it seems that the Roman guy could look at the stars and see that
I didn't say that no one ever had any understanding of these things. What I'm telling you is that the stuff that's available today, that you have in the newspapers, and these tarot cards and Ouija boards and all the rest of that kind of stuff, right? That's nonsense. I'm not saying that no one ever had the ability to do this. Yes, we do have on record people who did have this ability. Quite right. So, but, okay. Now, chapter 8, so he starts up with something extremely important. I've told you this in other guides, but I'll repeat it again. Part 2, chapter 8 is of absolutely fundamental importance. He says, one of the things that we have to distinguish in God's providence is that all of the rules of His providence and all of its ways, the straightness of judgment and the line of strict justice, he distinguishes here between mishpat and din. I don't know how he translates it. The fairest possible rule of justice. It's two things. The straightness of judgment and the line of strict justice. And he brings two verses, one of which refers to strict justice, the other refers to judgment. However, he says, we know in truth that God's desire is only to benefit, only to do good. That's His only desire. That's His only goal. That's His only purpose. And He loves His creatures as a father loves his child. And therefore, when God punishes, He does it only as a father who punishes his child in order to bring him to a greater good at the end. He quotes a verse. Therefore, he says, Mishpat and Din. Two terms over again. Judgment and strict justice themselves come from the source of love. And therefore, when the world punishes, it's not like the punishment of an enemy or someone who's taking revenge, but rather it is the instruction of a father who wants the good for his child. And that being the case, there are two corollaries. Number one, when the Musa comes, when the chastisement and instruction comes through punishment, it doesn't come, it comes with a certain sweetness to it. Not hard and cruel. Because the love of the parent and the child, love of God for his creature, will already... He has a word for air conditioning here. Kimzo means to mix things together and make a more balanced composition. The strict judgment will be tempered with mercy. That's one consequence. And the other consequence is that sometimes, when the time needs it, God will pass over strict justice altogether. He'll just ignore it. And He will treat the world with mercy. And justice will simply be put on hold. Put on hold and passed over. Now that applies just because judgment and strict justice are not independent principles. If they were independent principles, you could conceivably have a crisis. We spoke last night, what's today's Tuesday? The night before last, we spoke about democracy.
And one of the characteristics of Western democracies, though it has nothing to do with democracy, it's just an additional thing that Western governments have thought appropriate, is separation of powers. Which, as I told you then, is a misnomer. It's not separation of powers, it's separation of authorities. Nothing to do with power. The judiciary has no power. And one function of separation of these different branches of authority is to make the government crippled. To make it very difficult to do things. Because each branch has to worry about the other two branches. And by the time they all get together, you know, the thing's been discussed for 6 months and people have had time to thrash it out. And nobody can take over because he's got to worry about the other guys who want also their share of the power pie. If you thought that God has a principle of love and a principle of justice and a principle of judgment, you could worry what happens when each principle contradicts the other one in a particular case in terms of what to do. But it isn't like that. God is not like a committee. God is like a dictatorship with one at the top. Only one at the top. And everything else comes from that one at the top. And the one at the top is leitiv, to benefit, to do good, to give good. That's the only principle of the entire creation. And therefore, whenever judgment or strict justice is applied, it's applied for the purpose of benefit. That's what generates the two corollaries. The one that when the judgment and justice come, they come with that sweetened element. And number two, that sometimes it's ignored altogether because it will be too destructive. Now, I'll just say a word about the difference between those two terms, judgment and justice. Mishpat. Mishpat is a pretty broad term. Mishpat means looking at a situation and doing what's right for that situation. The key element in Mishpat, as he says several times in the book, is that Mishpat is reactive. It's reactive. Situation comes about, in our case it comes about through free will, usually. We act, and he reacts. It's a bit striking to say that about God, the Creator, who sustains the existence of everything, that he forms functions reactively, but the Ramchal says it exclusively. Mishpat has flexibility. Mishpat can take into account future consequences, can take into account dependencies, can take into account the different dimensions of a person. Din can't do that. Din looks at the action. Din is like an earthly court. You went through the red light, you're losing your license. Your whole family depends upon your ability to drive. And your children are going to starve. And your children aren't guilty. Why should they suffer? I'm not interested. You went through the red light, you lose your license. End of story. That's strict justice. That's din. Mishpat is broader and more flexible and incorporates the possibility of mercy. That's why he says that din is balanced with mercy. He doesn't say that Mishpat is balanced with mercy. I mean, this is how the precision of the Ramchal as an author. Din has to be balanced, but not Mishpat. Mishpat can include it. Yeah.
What purpose does God have with din at all?
The purpose is this, because if a person will be able to earn his success by the standards of strict din, then the person is the author of the success in the most complete way possible. And that's the goal. The goal is that the person himself should create his own success. If he can't do it in that way, so then God gives him extra help to do it, which means the quality of his success is reduced, but there'll be far more successes. And that's the playoff between quantity and quality, which we mentioned earlier. Okay, that's the beginning of chapter 8. We'll have to do some more chapter 8 tomorrow. And then we're chugging right along. Move on to chapter part 3. Good.
No, it's still recording, I think.